As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome back to The Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, March 24th. Stephen Nesbitt here filling in for DVR, who will be back in your podcast feed soon. And I'm joined, as always, by Keith Law in between draft scouting trips. Keith, how are you doing?
I'm good. Suffering from some seasonal allergies. Apparently in North Carolina, everything's blooming right now, but it's not in Delaware. So that was fun.
Nice way to find out.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I got off the plane in Raleigh. And I think I walked outside and it was like, bam! And all of a sudden I was allergic to air.
Just hit by a wall. So yeah. We're going to get into some draft prospects talk today. Now that we've got a large enough sample of these college arms, college bats, to get a decent read on the top guys, what is a pretty fascinating class. And later in the show, we'll get to some other potential breakout candidates at the major league level and young players prepping to, I guess, potentially win an opening day roster spot just a week from now. So let's get this rolling here, Keith, with the draft class. We're just under 4 months. It's you can see the finish line here, right? How many mock drafts until then?
Probably, God, three or four. I won't do one until much later in the spring. I'd say May or so. It's funny. I just was chatting with a national guy last night whose team picks in the top half. And it was like, well, you know, essentially it was, we're going to get someone good, but we have no idea who's getting to us. I mean, that's the problem that I find with doing mock drafts too early, is that there's just way too much. Even the teams at the top haven't decided. So there's way too much uncertainty. But I will say, I think this is the best draft class in a decade. It is really, it's very strong on the college side. The high school position player side looks pretty good. We'll see about the high school pitchers. I'm obviously not a huge fan of them just in the first round. Like, I recognize their prospects, but they carry a lot of risk. Andrew Painter is hurt now, and Jackson Jobe is hurt now. And so, but the high school pitching class seems as good as is typical. And when you boost that with a strong college class overall, I'd say, which I think is a lot because 3 years ago, right, we had the pandemic shortened draft, and a lot of these kids never played at all the entire spring, or barely played, and so ended up going to college. And so now we're reaping the benefits of having a terrible draft year in 2020. So it's turned out to be, yeah, really fun. It's exciting. I'm going to have plenty to do. I've already seen a bunch of top guys, and I'm getting on a plane again tomorrow and then again on Monday. And I got a lot of guys left to see, which is fun. Like, I'd much rather have this problem, too many guys to see and not enough weekends, than the reverse, which is I don't want to go anywhere. Who am I going to see next Friday? Which was last year was, like, not to complain about my job, but like, there weren't enough Friday night starters to potentially go see. So this is much better.
The conversation at the top of the draft hasn't necessarily changed, but I think it's gotten more interesting. You had ranked 1 and 2 just a couple weeks ago, Wyatt Langford, outfielder from Florida, and Dylan Cruz, outfielder from LSU. Langford has been hurt. Nothing that should be long term, but hit a foul ball off himself, had surgery.
Not in a baseball
sense.
I'm hoping he can still have kids someday.
He can read between the lines on that injury. So he is the more tooled up guy, probably can stay in center field, whereas Cruz is going to end up being a corner guy, but they're both putting up absurd numbers so far this season. I mean, Cruz, I think it's a 5.515 batting average, .650, six on base percentage that'll play. So when you look at 1-2, assuming Langford is back and healthy and there is no significant injury for either of them, where do you sit right now on the 1-2 conversation and the pros and cons?
So I think I wrote, like, you could kind of go either way. And I leaned towards Langford. He looked better in the first couple of weeks. Scouts are coming back to me saying this is the better prospect. There's more upside. He doesn't play center for Florida, but he should be able to play center. He's a plus-plus runner, at least underway. But they have a freshman, Robertson. I think he's a freshman. I just saw them, who can really play center. And I think that's kind of the main reason why Langford has been playing a corner this year. And there's some risk there, right? That you haven't actually seen him do it in center. Whereas Cruz projects to move to a corner, but he does play center now. So you can at least, you have that possibility in front of you and it's easier to evaluate, right? That will be a question in draft rooms, the top couple, you know, both these guys are going in the top 2-3 picks, where it'll be like, well, we haven't really seen him play center. And what if we draft him on the basis that he will be able to move to center and he can't do it? That happened with Corey Ray, that happened with Derek Fisher. These guys never did figure out center field. Turns out neither guy was even very good in left field when they got into pro ball. You know, for me, I would rather roll the dice a little bit on the greater upside of the better athlete and the guy with, I think, the better long-term chance to stay in the middle. But both can hit, both have power, both have really good plate discipline, and both play in the SEC. So while their early season competition hasn't been great, and this is particularly true for Cruz, what we'll see the rest of the way, Cruz is just, it's going to be good pitching pretty much every weekend the whole rest of the season. And I wonder if that hurts Langford a little bit and that he's going to miss a couple of weeks at least and thus miss opportunities for scouts to see him against good quality arms, because the SEC, I mean, it's always the best conference, but it's really good this year.
Right. Another year where I suppose the benefit of having a later draft is you can see these guys the whole way through. So an injury, an injury that takes Langford out for a few weeks won't necessarily do huge damage to his draft stock, which obviously is very, very high. If you're the Pirates sitting there at 1-1, and let's imagine a scenario where they want the best guy on their board instead of somebody that's going to save some money for them, they are not a team that is loaded with outfield prospects. Your top 20 for them this spring, Matt Gorski, number 17, was your only one in the top 20. If I'm looking at their current roster,
right? Holy cow. And I just saw him last week, and I was, he's 17th. Like, not like you're banking on him. He's super, you've probably seen him at some point, super tooled up, but the field of hit is just, it just hasn't happened. And I'm not shocked, but still, like, it's also a little tantalizing too. You look at this guy, he's such a good athlete, it's big power, he can run, etc. It's like, man, he is just not going to hit, is he?
And when you're drafting in 2023, you're not necessarily drafting based on the need of when you expect this guy to get to the majors. You'll figure it out. But they are a team that's had to, you know, Jiwon Bae maybe at center fielder at some point. Brian Reynolds, is he going to stay? O'Neill Cruz, will he move to a corner? I don't know really what their future is. When you look at what they have going on, would that tip you in either direction on whether long-term it would make more sense for them to go with Langford or Cruz?
I don't think so. I think they should. It's best player available, and the best player available is going to be one of those two outfielders. Like, I don't think there are some good college pitchers this year. We may talk about them in a minute. I don't think any of those guys is in the 1-1 conversation. If they chose to go with a high school player, and there are three who were in my top 10 who would not be outrageous pick one, I think they would be, it would be a money saver. And the Pirates did do that 2 years ago with Henry Davis, who was second on my board. Marcelo Mayer was first on my board, and I think first kind of the consensus or closest thing we had to a consensus 1-1, but they saved like $2 million taking Davis and then ended up really doing great things with that savings later on in the draft. You know, they could take one of those guys, but I really think the best option for them is going to be to take Langford or Cruz, and either one of them is probably the right choice. It should be wherever they feel better. I would say if I'm in that draft room, and not that they need me, I think they've done a very good job the last couple of years, but the main consideration should be, who do we feel is going to have the most impact, especially with the bat? Because that's just been such a huge issue for this organization for like 10 years now. I mean, who's the last real impact hitter with some thump that this organization has developed, drafted or signed and developed? Because Reynolds wasn't theirs originally.
Neither was O'Neill Cruz.
No, that's true, actually. Right. I always forget that. But yes, you're correct. And I mean, he hasn't even done it yet. Like, I think he will be, certainly. But I mean, who was the last guy, right? It's been a long time. And I think a lot of it was player development, especially under the previous regime. There was such an emphasis on contact that a lot of their guys who should have impacted the ball more ended up not doing so. And we're still waiting for like a Cabrian Hayes to at least get into more. I don't think he's elite power, but I always thought he'd hit for more power. Kevin Newman's a guy I believed in quite a bit as a prospect. He got to the big leagues and it was just the like little soft cut, like don't strike out. No, that's not. At some point you got to let it unleash it a little bit. And there, I thought it was system wide that they weren't doing that, and it has left them in a situation where it's good for them that we're talking about two guys who do project to impact the ball. And I would actually say, if I were in the Pirates organization, I might tilt a little bit more towards whose bat do you believe in more, and maybe weight the position and speed a little bit less, just because they've had such a hard time finding thump for the middle of the lineup.
No, you're right there. Picking someone, an impact bat there is, I mean, if you consider Starling Marte an impact bat, I mean, he's more speed plus good contact. That's worked. He had some power over the years. That might be it. I mean, the Gregory Polanco's of the world didn't pan out. It is a long time. You're going back to before that. I mean, it's Pedro Alvarez for a while, and McCutcheon and Neil Walker. So it's been a problem. And getting a bat at the top of the lineup or top of the draft, just like they've done these last couple of drafts. I mean, there's a reason that they're targeting these guys in the first round. So moving on to a handful of these college arms that you mentioned. You had five guys in the top 13 when you ranked your first go at this top 30. And it's gotten interesting. Chase Dolander was the top guy you had rated, followed by Paul Skeens. You had a couple guys bunched in at the 10 to 13 range, Hurston Waldrep, Rhett Lauder, and Will Sanders. Skeens is on fire. He's having an unbelievable first five starts. And Dolander has been less dominant, certainly, as we saw last year. Walk me through what you're thinking today on where those guys land. Skeens, I mean, what he's done after the transfer is pretty special.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, he's the top college arm right now, right? Yeah. And if the Pirates were, I don't think they will, and I'm not necessarily saying they should, but if they wanted to consider an arm at 1-1, that's the guy. He has absolutely established himself as the best college pitcher right now, and Dolander has dropped to the point where he might be behind. He's certainly behind Waldrop. He may be behind Lauder at this point, and then Sanders has also not been great. I saw Sanders, actually. I've seen Sanders and Waldrop of that group so far. I'll see Lauder this weekend. Dolander, I've actually just been kicking the can down the road because he hasn't been good at all.
Yeah.
So for folks who don't know, Dolander last year, he was the Saturday night guy for Tennessee, but people were already saying this is a potential 1-1 guy for next year because it was velocity, it was strikes, and it was a plus-plus slider, like an absolute wipe, especially if you got him on his best nights last year. He had a start against, I think it was Mississippi late in the season, where it was just like, yeah, that's the type of guy who goes in the top two or three picks. That's what they look like. And he's had five starts this year, and the slider hasn't been there. Just talking to a guy the other day who had seen not Dolander's most recent start, but the one before that, he said he flashed a couple plus, but the majority were just like slightly below average. And to me, it's like, was he hurt? Like, you don't just lose a pitch like that without some underlying explanations. It's really concerning. I don't know how, if you didn't have history with Dolander, how do you take that guy, say, in the top 10 when the single pitch that was his best pitch is simply not there? And that was even true before he had an outing against Missouri, which doesn't really have a great lineup by SEC standards. And they had five runs, tagged him for five runs. He only threw 43 pitches. He got a single swing and miss, and it was actually on the fastball, not even on the slider at that point. And I mean, to me, I just don't know. I really don't know what you do with him. And that certainly drops him down some of these other guys who've posted. I mean, Waldrop hasn't been elite, but he has shown up. He has thrown, he's missing bats. The command isn't really where you want it to be. He's at Florida, just to be clear. Rhett Lauder is at Wake Forest. Will Sanders is at South Carolina. And I think it's creating some opportunities for other guys potentially to creep up. And that's generally what happens. We get into conference play, too. It's true for hitters and pitchers. And now we start to see, all right, these hot starts for some of these guys. How much of this is real? How much of this is actually going to carry over to SEC competition or ACC competition? I would even say that's true for Big 12 and the Pac-10 are not, or Pac-12, whatever, however many schools they have. They're not what they were necessarily. They're not up to the caliber of these other conferences, but still, like, you're facing better competition. I saw Will Sanders against Bethune-Cookman, and I mean, those poor kids. Like, I don't think a lot of those Bethune kids had seen 95 before. And, you know, it's just not, I mean, I hope the school got some money for going to play there, because it was 20-3 and ended on a mercy rule, which I've never seen a college game end on that before. I will say there was one kid, I apologize for not remembering his name, but once the game was out of hand, one of the Bethune hitters clearly was just like, I'm swinging hard at a fastball, and he homered. I'm like, that's awesome, right? Someday he will be like, I homered off this guy who got to the big leagues. And he was like, try not to over-celebrate, right? Because they were down by 10-plus runs at that point. But still, you could tell, like, inside, there was a little pride. It's like, all right, I did a thing. And his teammates, like, it was appropriate, right? It was very right. Like, you can celebrate that. We all recognize that this was pretty cool for you. But that's, you know, to me, an extreme example of what happens early in these springs. Like, not every school plays a strong slate. The vast majority of these bigger schools don't play good non-conference competition. So it's once we turn the calendar into conference play by the fifth weekend, then you can start to look at weekly performance just a little differently. It's not everything, but it certainly matters a lot more to me what these both position players and pitchers do from here on out.
Some of the conversation around Paul Skeens, who certainly looks the part on the mound, 6'6" guy, is coming over from Air Force. He was a two-way player who excelled at both and probably could be a top, five-round guy, either one. And I think, just my personal opinion, I think that LSU's done right by him to have him only pitch so far, unless I'm mistaken.
I would say so.
It certainly is
about $2 million.
it has worked out really nicely. But as fans, I think, because we have discovered Shohei Ohtani and don't want to accept that he's a unicorn, think just like imagine the value that could be there if a guy sure, let's let him focus on pitching, but once every few days maybe in the minors let him hit. Like, what is the likely, not necessarily Skeens, but like are we have not seen it work with people other than Ohtani to a super successful level. What are the odds that a team would actually be willing to let a guy come into a first round pitcher come in into the to pro ball and start doing two-way stuff again? Or is it just not worth it at this point and you can add it later on if you really believe it's there?
I think we've seen a couple of examples. I feel like Bubba Chandler's maybe the biggest one, like in terms of prospect status, where a team has allowed him to do both. But it's because I'm reading between the lines a little bit on what Pirates people are saying and also what I think of the player. He's a pitcher. He's going to end up a pitcher. And he wants to keep hitting. Yeah, fine. There's not really any big harm in that. The other way around entails so much more risk, right? Because then the guy gets hurt. If you have a two-way prospect who you really believe is a much more better prospect as a hitter, and you let him continue to pitch and he gets hurt pitching, as happens, even to guys with like good deliveries, et cetera, then you're an idiot, right? I mean, the perception will be, how could you let this happen, right? Why did you? We never thought he was going to be a pitcher. That, I think, is going to hold a lot of guys back. There's a guy in this year's draft in Northern Virginia, high school kid, Bryce Eldridge, who is one of those, a little bit like Chandler, might be a first rounder either way. And we'll see. Maybe some team just takes him and says he's a pitcher and we're going to let him pitch. But I have a feeling that could be one of those where if a team thinks he's a pitcher, they'll let him continue to hit. If a team thinks he's a position player, it'll be, we're just taking you as a position player, not risking that. Funny story about him. So I get a text from my sister last night who lives in Virginia, and she sends me a photo of a screenshot of Eldridge's page on the Perfect Game website. And she goes, have you ever heard of this guy? And I'm like, yes, why? And my nephew's friend's older brother played his, plays high school baseball player, played Eldridge's team. And the other mom was saying, oh yeah, there were a whole bunch of scouts there. And obviously my sister knows enough to like, all right, I can figure out who this might be. And I was like, yeah, I need, and I think there was also like, when are you coming to see him? And it's like, yeah, I guess I will be coming to see, I will be coming to visit. He is the best high school player in Virginia. He's probably the best high school player in the, maybe in the Mid-Atlantic this year. And so it's a dry, it's very drivable for me. But yeah, that was one of those like, oh, worlds are slightly colliding here. Also, it's very good for me to hear there were a lot of scouts there. It's like, that's where I need to go. When I show up and there's no scouts in the ballpark, I get very, very nervous. Like, oh my God, what did I do? Is he not playing? Does he? Is he terrible? Is everyone hanging out without me somewhere else? So that was, yes, that's very reassuring to know that, yep, okay, I got the right guy on my list.
Rounding out the college talk here is, if you had to pick from one of these, I would say maybe top three, infield prospects coming out of college this year, who do you see as the safer bet between Jacob Gonzalez, Braden Taylor, and I think I would throw in Jacob Wilson maybe as the number three? I could be missing someone there.
I think you're right.
Who do you think is the safest bet there to be an above average major league regular?
That's a great question. I think if you asked 20 scouts, you'd get a pretty close, you'd probably pretty close to an even breakdown across the three. If we're talking safest bet to be an above average big leaguer, I probably lean towards Taylor. I think he can really hit. I think he's got work to do defensively. But I feel the best about not just his ability to put the bat on the ball, because that's Wilson. Wilson absolutely has the best for that. I mean, he struck out 7 times all last spring. And I know it's Grand Canyon, they didn't face the greatest competition, but still, like, nobody strikes out that infrequently. But Taylor's going to hit the ball. He already is hitting the ball hard enough that it's going to carry over, and it's not just going to be, you know, empty contact. And bring up Kevin Newman again, right? You don't want that. We don't want that. We have better data now, too, to make sure we don't overrate the guys with just strong contact ability but who don't impact the ball. And so Wilson has the best contact rate of the three. If you were just talking about who's the best chance to simply get to the big leagues and be anything at all, anything better than replacement, that's Gonzalez. Gonzalez is the guy who goes in the top 5 or 6 picks to some team that's like, we want certainty. We absolutely cannot miss on this particular pick for whatever reason, lots of reasons why that might be true. And to me, that's Gonzalez, where it's very steady. I don't think there's a ton of upside. The odds of him becoming an all-star are not that great, but the odds of him being less than an average or fringe average regular are also not that great. It could be, I think most people would be very, very surprised if Gonzalez, barring injury, didn't get there and have a career. Whereas with Wilson, I could see questions about the impact because it is such a contact-focused approach. And with Taylor, there are other questions. You know, he swings and misses a little bit more, and I don't know for sure that he stays at third base. So there's other questions, but he's got some more upside. So to your point about above-average regular or better, I think I'd still go with Taylor, acknowledging the risk.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Moving on to some potential breakout candidates at the major league level. Keith, you just wrote about this the other day. I encourage everyone to go check out that list. Our last show, we we mentioned and we I think we cursed Andrew Painter and Kate Cavalli, so we're gonna operate with caution today. We've had to tiptoe.
Everyone taking, stop listening. Just stop.
Taking guys off the list. So with that with that disclaimer said, you started with Brian Bello, who I see a lot of Red Sox living over here in the Boston area, and he's a guy who the numbers just kind of surprised me last year. When I look at the full body of work, I just saw better than what they told me. And it's hard to put up an ERA that's creeping toward five when you only allow one homer in 57 innings. But I guess that can happen when you're walking guys at, they get like a 4.2 walks per nine and have a 404 BABIP. I guess that can happen, right?
Yeah. Yes. And I am going to say with some degree of confidence, he won't allow a 404 BABIP this year. I'm going to just go way out on a limb here and say, I think that's probably not going to happen. And I gave credit in a column. I'll give credit here too. I had Justin Havens on my podcast back in January. He and I worked together for a long time at ESPN. And he also mentioned Bello as one of his two big breakout candidates for this year. And I absolutely agree with him. I think there's all the ingredients there potentially for Bello to step forward and be a league average starter, if not better. It's stuff. I think there's way better command and control than what we saw last year. And I try not to read too much into what a guy does in his first season or half season, as the case was with Bello, for him to, you know, yeah, he walked a few more guys, but that I don't think that's as predictive as like his whole minor league career, where he certainly was not that kind of guy, never projected to be a particularly erratic control guy. And I think there's multiple weapons there for him to miss bats, and I think that's going to be the thing that carries him. I think his BABIP will come down, but also he's just not going to, I think, allow as many balls in play on a rate basis going forward. And you know, I don't love predicting breakouts for pitchers because they'll really break your heart, right? You put a breakout guy on your list and then he gets hurt next week and he's out for the year. So, but he was one of, I think, two on the whole list, which is like, no, I see all the indicators here for him to take a pretty big step forward. And, you know, not for nothing, the Red Sox need it. Who was the last homegrown starting pitcher they developed? It's been a minute since they had a guy who was one of their own, right? Drafted or signed and developed all the way to the big leagues, who was even a league average starter. You know, Clay Buchholz, maybe? That's...
We're going
that's
back.
That's a long time to go. Yeah, right? That's not great. And a system that does not have a lot of future starters in it, too. So, you know, it's not necessarily fair to Bello, but they are counting on him to become a quality starter so that they another guy, one guy at least to anchor the rotation who they can try to build around by going externally.
You included two Tigers, Riley Green and Matt Vierling, and also mentioned Spencer Torkelson as a possibility for that list. It is a wild ride looking at the Tigers projected lineup here on Roster Resource on Fangraphs. It is a lineup that tells me, oh, it could be an interesting team in 2025 and maybe competing in 2026, and then you see Javi Baez as the one guy just sticking out like a sore thumb. What was that all about? That's what happens when you try to jump out of a rebuild too soon and then start over with a new front office and decide to keep this train started over again. So anyway, Riley Green is the guy I love for this year. I mean, he showed some really a really good bat, good speed, good defense. I mean, I just like his future a lot. And you made a really good point, I think, in this piece saying his elevated strike, I don't remember what the stat was. He had an elevated strike rate, but it was more called strikes than it was swing and miss. It was a much more correctable problem.
Oh, yeah. And that's right. That's the thing we look for if you're delving just into pitch data for hitters, too. Okay, is he swinging and missing? And then what is he swinging and missing at? Or where is he swinging and missing? And how much of a concern is that, right? Guys who are swinging and missing at fastballs in the zone. Yeah, that's pretty bad, actually. I'll never forget seeing Michael Choice before we even had that data, but seeing him in college, I mean, the guy swinging and missing at fastball strikes. I think that's bad. And I wasn't even that sure at the time, right? Because it was not something that was even discussed as much. We were just at the point where scouts were starting to try to record this stuff. But, you know, in Green's case, it's not swinging and missing. And at anything, not at rates that are at all incompatible with him becoming a star. It's a lot of just deciding to swing a bit more. And that is absolutely correctable. It's also something I think guys really do naturally get better with experience. And this is a guy who moved very quickly through the minors, right? When you consider any of these guys, especially I feel like high school guys who were drafted in 18 or 19 and then lost 20, right? He has less experience or had less minor league experience getting to the big leagues than historically most guys who got to the majors at his age did. And so I also feel like for that entire class, Bobby Witt was in that draft class, CJ Abrams was in that draft class. Don't be surprised at all if those guys take bigger leaps in the big leagues than you might have expected for players their ages and pedigrees, because they typically, that stuff would have happened in the minors before we even got to see them in the majors. And I feel like Green is the one where I like all three of those guys long term, but Green was the one I looked at and said, I see the most potential for him to actually take that step forward this year. And I'm glad you mentioned Torkelson. I mean, one reason I didn't put Torkelson on the main list was I would have had three Tigers in 11 names, since people would be like, are you a Tigers fan? Which is something I've pretty much never been accused of in my life. But, you know, Torkelson, Mike Petriello tweeted something. Torkelson's been hitting the ball as hard as just about anybody this spring. And we already knew he could do that. That wasn't the main issue last year. But I just wanted to mention him in the column and here too. Like, don't give up on this guy, right? He was the first pick for a reason. And I do still think he's going to be a good big leaguer. But I just feel like Green has a better chance to take a step forward and be a star. And Vierling, to me, is a guy who has a chance to go from basically replacement level to solid regular. And I don't think there's a whole lot standing in his way from doing that. And they're going to be really interesting to watch. I wish that they had some healthy pitching, but I will take... You know, and maybe Tigers fans hopefully feel the same way. If the lineup takes a nice step forward this year from two or even all three of those guys really progressing, that's good. They'll be the most interesting Tigers team to watch in several years now.
Yeah, I mean, in your defense, when a lineup underperforms by a mile at almost every single guy up and down the roster, there's a lot of breakout candidates next year. A lot this of guys true. Who can bounce back.
This is true. Well, at least they're not playing a bunch of, like, 30-year-old, you know, has been fill-in guys. I mean, nothing, no offense to those guys, but fans aren't going to get excited as opposed to like, hey, Riley Green becomes an all-star this year. Fans are into that and saying, great, we got this guy for the next 5+ years potentially. That's a player to sort of get attached to a little bit and get excited. All right, that's the first real building block in our lineup going forward. And I would not surprise me if two or all three of those guys were, and they're going to end up in a great situation too. Cause I think Parker Meadows, who they just sent down earlier this week, I'm on that. And and that's somebody who was very bearish on Meadows when they drafted him his first couple of years. I saw him in fall league last year and the big hitch he had in his swing, they'd really cleared up. And then he was really, really good this spring, even against the limited chances he got to face better pitching. He's got to carry it forward into the regular season when the performance actually means something. But I am quite optimistic. We're going to see Meadows in the big leagues before the midpoint, and that I think he'll make a real difference for them.
When I look at the Phillies and their lineup, I see they have almost all their bases covered. Yet when I look at third base, I just feel like there's something lacking. And Alec Bohm, he hasn't played up to his potential, and that's true. But I see a guy who's a 275 hitter with mediocre OBP and maybe average at best pop. So talk me into why Alec Bohm is a good breakout candidate for this year.
This guy should be given the swing, given the contact quality, and given the swing decisions. He's never going to be a great OBP guy, I don't think. And there are various reasons for that. Not the least of which is Phillies haven't been very good at developing that for quite some time now. But I think Bohm is going to hit for the contact quality is going to come through in higher average, more hits on the balls he is hitting into play, and some more over the fence power. And I think that's actually been coming for a little while. I really wish he didn't have to play third base. I do wonder if that's a situation where if he just wasn't playing third, right, would this just not be an issue anymore? Like, I had Andrew Vaughn on that list because maybe just not playing the outfield, which you're not capable of playing. Sorry, Andrew, really like your bat. Saw you in college, never thought outfield was going to work. Like, dude, just go stand at first base and just hit. And, you know, the Phillies have kind of boxed themselves into a little bit of a corner. They have lots of guys who are playing positions they kind of can't really play defensively. So they don't have the flexibility to move guys like they might otherwise need to. But I do... And so if Bohm does break out, as I sort of predicted here, it may not show up as much in the war because his defensive number is going to drag him down. But I think you're going to see a boost to the batting average and to the power, whether that's a lot more doubles or just a bunch more balls over the fence. Like, I think that'll carry forward. But I also concede the point, right? He's not going to be a high OBP guy. And obviously his overall numbers are not going to look great once you factor in the defense, because I just don't think he's ever going to be more than like a 45 defender at third. If I'm the Phillies right now and that's what I'm getting defensively, I'll live with that, because they've pretty clearly decided we don't really care if we catch the ball. Right?
They're living with that all over the field.
Absolutely. I mean, it could not be any more clearly a strategy. We're going to pitch and we're going to hit dingers.
You're right. There is a fit for that sort of profile in this lineup. It's got so many sluggers, and it's now got Trey Turner, who is going to bat 300 as well with a better OBP, certainly, and speed. And he does a lot of things. I love the fit of Trey Turner on that team, and I don't have to pay the money for those years, so it's fine. And if Bohm can be a 290, 295 hitter, and if he gets closer to 15, you know, 20 homers, like you're right, I can see that a lot, and the defense is for the birds, as they say. So I do like that. Let's jump on one last here. I like that you included Keber Ruiz with the Nationals. This dude's going to give you like the lowest strikeout rate in the majors. You can kind of pencil him in for best five there. And I just think there's a lot more in this bat, and he just locked up a contract extension. He's going to be there for a long time. This is a team that doesn't have a ton of proven talent, but there are a lot of things to watch for, and I think Ruiz is at the top of that list.
Yeah, I have always thought there was going to be power there when he caught up age-wise, or he's always really young for where he played. I saw him first time he was, might have been 19, and saw him homer twice in a minor league spring training game, but I was like, oh, that's in there, right? Don't forget that potential is in there. In the swing, he was clear, and I actually thought he was plenty strong. I wonder if it's a little bit like we were talking about guys like Jack Wilson, guys like Kevin Newman too, or the Pirates system in general. Has this always just been such a contact approach? Like, it's okay to strike out a little bit if that's balanced out by putting more balls in seats. He's getting older. He's getting to the point now where we're expecting his power to really come through in games too. And I just try to be mindful too of what we know from baseball history of when guys have typically reached their peak power level. They don't all do it right away. Plenty of guys do, right? But they're not all Julio Rodriguez. Somebody actually, one of my readers made this comment in the comments under the breakouts piece where somebody was slagging Riley Green. He's never going to be as good as Julio Rodriguez. Hey, he may never be as good as Julio Rodriguez. Julio's pretty special. But at the same time, they don't all mature at exactly the same rate. And we've been spoiled by so many players getting to the big leagues at 19, 20, becoming stars right away. Still lots of room for players to get there 3-4 years later and become stars. And that's, we'd all like them to do it faster, but these are humans doing a very, very difficult job. And I think it's not fair to tag someone as a disappointment or to drastically lower your expectations just because maybe his first year in the big leagues wasn't quite up to his pre-big leagues expectations.
Rounding out this conversation, I wanted to hit on a few guys who are still in the conversation, I think, for opening day roster spots, and some really interesting players, but we're in the season of, what is it, asset management or roster player retention. Teams are doing jumping through hoops to try to keep the minor league invite or the all the spring training invite guys around. So just want to get your thoughts on a couple of these guys, sort of the headliners. Brett Beatty has given the Mets a difficult decision to make. For a while, I guess it's been Eduardo Escobar that's been penciled in at third base. This guy seems like he's doing all the right things, and he got a taste of the majors last year and would expect a step forward as well.
Yeah, and I think the Mets, they're in this situation, right? This team's already pretty good. They can integrate a guy like Beatty now. And even if he struggles, which I don't really forecast, this guy already showed he can hit the ball really hard. He's a big, strong kid with really good feel to hit. The biggest question on him has just been consistently getting the ball in the air. And I know they've worked with him on this, and we saw some improvements last year, particularly in the minors. I'm confident it'll get there this year. But if you're in their situation, one, the rest of the team is so good, you can afford to give him some time to develop in the majors. And two, they just sent Francisco Alvarez down the other day. I'm sure the intent is to get him to the majors at some point this season. And so I do believe in this idea of, especially when you're trying to contend, right? Integrating sort of one guy at a time. Let Beatty get a month or so in the big leagues. You let him get his feet under him, and hopefully you start to see adjustments at that point. Then you can bring up the next guy and bring up the next guy so that you are not creating a situation, especially when you are the Mets and it's all eyes on you, on the one loss record, that hopefully you rack up some wins too early as Beatty gets integrated, and then you can bring up the next guy and bring up the next guy, as opposed to, you know, trying to play two, three rookies or very young guys at the same time. You're trying to develop them at the same time. You're also trying to win. And then suddenly you end up in this, you end up in a situation where you might be making decisions based strictly on winning and losing right now. And I don't want to see that. Oh, Beatty has a tough first 3 weeks of the season. Oh my God, we got to change something. Give Escobar the job, send Beatty back down. I don't think the Mets are going to do that. But I think the chances of that increase if you're trying to bring in too many guys at the same time.
Oscar Colas seems to have the inside track on the White Sox right field job. The competition, I think, is probably Gavin Sheets, number one. He's a guy we don't know quite as much because he came over from Cuba. Haven't had as much experience watching him. What sort of upside do you see for Colas?
I think long-term, he might get to like a 55, an above-average regular. I don't think he's got a chance to be a star. I do have questions, especially about some of the breaking ball recognition, off-speed recognition in general, really. And I think that's going to hold down his contact rate and thus hold down some of his other numbers. But I also think there's a lot of things he can do right now. He's a touch older than most of the other prospects on my rankings. And I could very much see him. And that's not a criticism. It's just because he's a Cuban defector and when he came over, when he signed. But I do think he is going to end up being being able to make an impact for them this year. I would much rather give him a chance than play Gavin Sheets out there, especially because I don't think Gavin Sheets is very good defensively. And I think Colas in an outfield corner especially will be able to provide some defensive value. And if that's what he is a guy who plays good defense in a corner and whacks fastballs, that's a decent path to being an average big league regular. And he's going to swing and miss some. You know, and he's not Luis Robert. I get it. I know there was a lot of hope. Oh, it's another Cuban outfielder. Maybe we've got the same kind of upside. They're not the same human. They're not the same type of player. But I think Colas can help this team right now. And it's fortunate. He's arriving at exactly the point where they need him, too.
In Yankees camp, they have a number of shortstop options, but they seem to be clearing the way to, at some point in the nearish future, give the job to Anthony Volpe. He's having a great spring. Oswald Peraza is there. Oswaldo Cabrera is there. They appear to be moving IKF, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, to more of a super utility role. Volpe, opening day lineup, is that where you see him as part of that group, or is he probably going to be in a sort of second wave of the season?
I would guess, I don't know what the Yankees are thinking specifically, but I would guess, because they also have Peraza, who is a better defensive shortstop than Volpe. And I would like to see Volpe go to AAA for just a couple of weeks, and because he had very little time there at the end of last year, and let Peraza play short in the big leagues so they can get a further evaluation of him, and then also decide what do they want to do with both of these guys long term. They are both shortstops. They're both good enough, in my opinion. I saw a lot of them last year just by virtue of where I live. Both are good enough to play shortstop in the big leagues. Do you want to keep Peraza at short because he is the better defender of the two and move Volpe to another position? Or do you decide Volpe is so valuable as a potential shortstop that we will take, you know, maybe a half grade less of defense? Maybe it's more like a full grade. I don't know. But it's less defense, but for that much more overall value. I mean, to me, if you move Volpe to second base, I have zero question he can play it and will play it extremely well, probably immediately. But if you leave him at short, you've got a chance for a superstar because of the positional value and because he does so much with the. I mean, he's such an impressive player. The more I watched him, the more I realized, too, it is. Yeah, it's going to show up in the performance. Obviously, he can really run. He's got some power. He's going to hit for average. He's got a really good idea at the plate. This guy is a really advanced player for his age, though. That is your classic kind of high IQ player, where his instincts on both sides of the ball are so good. I think the comment, I don't know where I wrote this exactly, he was that player where you watch the pitch, you watch the batter, and then you look, and Volpe's already in position. He's just constantly there. I saw him try to start a double play last year for Double-A Somerset, where he was too fast for his own second baseman. The ball got to him, and he just picked it up, turned, and threw, because that's what you do. And the second baseman wasn't even there. The second baseman's first step wasn't good enough to keep up with Volpe. And it was an error, and it ended up costing them a run, et cetera. And I'm like, you know what? I'm okay with that error. I'm completely fine with that because Volpe is playing at major league speed right now. And the second baseman just wasn't, right? He wasn't that good of a player. Wasn't that it wasn't as instinctive as Volpe was. And I'm like, yep, I'm fine with this. Volpe is going to be the kid who makes really quick, significant adjustments once he gets to the big leagues. That's also an argument not to rush him. Like, I'm fine with sending a guy like that down for a couple weeks to start the season because they have other options too. It's not like they're going to play, nothing at short. It's not the Orioles playing Jorge Mateo, right? They have Peraza, who they can give an opportunity to while they let Volpe play a couple more weeks, and they, you know, evaluate Peraza while Volpe gets to go down. And if he destroys AAA for a couple of weeks, great, call him up, and then you figure that out.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
With Jose Altuve out with a broken thumb, the Astros return probably do either Mauricio Dubon or David Hensley. Hensley is the more unknown guy here. He's a big middle infielder, 6'6". And he has outplayed Dubon this spring, and it'd be interesting to see him get the regular run in this sort of audition period. Is he someone you see as anything more than a fringe major leaguer type moving forward? Could he be part of their future?
He could be. I don't know where. He's a pretty good player, actually. You know, just a very, very, like, a pretty late bloomer, right? I was actually looking, I had to look, 26th round. They don't even draft that long anymore. And didn't reach the majors until 26. I think he was a senior sign, actually, looking at this, right? He was 22 in his draft year. So, you know, probably just a money saver, but he came out of the pandemic a pretty different guy and has continued to improve each year, and he's a better athlete. It's funny, I remember talking to a pro scout this winter for my prospect rankings, and he was pushing Hensley a little bit. He's like, I know that he doesn't, he's an older guy. He didn't realize that Hensley was in the big leagues a little too much, so he no longer qualifies. Right. But he was like, that guy might be a regular at some point. And you're right, he is really big for an infielder. 6'6 is pretty exceptional by historical standards, but he can hit. I think there's enough bat there that he could end up, maybe he's not a regular for the Astros once Altuve returns, but he could be somebody's regular. I mean, maybe he ends up playing for a couple of months, plays well enough, and they trade him to a team that does have an opening for him. And it stinks a little bit because I really liked Mauricio Dubon as a prospect, not as a star at all, but just a really, really solid player. Kid with another high IQ guy for me. Great instincts, play a bunch of positions, played hard all the time. Hensley's got more bat, and that may be the thing that carries him at this point.
In the post-Dansby Swanson world in Atlanta, they're going for now with Orlando Arcia over Vaughn Grissom. Grissom had a really nice rookie season, probably showed more of the bat than a lot of people expected, and maybe more than he can sustain long term. Were you surprised by that move? I understand they're going to want to get him more run at shortstop. People allowed a second place base last year. This, of course, could be, as we said, asset retention or whatever. Surprised by the move to send down Grissom?
No, Grissom got to the big. Grissom was great in the big leagues last year, way better than I thought he would be, given his just limited experience. He hadn't played that much before last year, just in terms of actual at bats in the minors. Again, another pandemic casualty in that sense, and not played much in the high minors at all. He really popped at the beginning of last year, where, you know, he wasn't even close to my top 100 going into 22, and then when I did a midseason ranking, I think he was on it. He might have been actually the last name. I did 60, and he was 59 or 60. And then he was in the big leagues a few minutes later and then just played way better than I anticipated. And that's great, but also I worry about the sustainability. We'd hardly be the first guy to come up in August or September and hit above expectations, then come back the next year, maybe not hit up to that. And then it sort of colors the whole your team's or your or the industry's opinion of a player. I am fine letting that guy go back down to the minors and gain some more upper minors experience. And hey, same thing as with Volpe too. If Grissom goes back down and mashes, great. There is no harm to me in that happening to a young and somewhat inexperienced player like that for a month, right? This should not be a hold him down for the whole season. If he's mashing in AAA for 3 months, then I might have some questions. But you know, hold him down for, not hold him down, let him go down there for a month, 6 weeks, something like that. And if we see the performances there and the batted ball data supports it, great, call him up. And you're, you know, then at that point, you're in a great situation. You have a good, difficult decision to make.
Saving the probably biggest question for last, Jordan Walker in Cardinals camp. He is making a big push to do it. Grissom did last year and jump from AA to the majors. It would impact playing time for a lot of Cardinals, and the Cardinals have a good lineup and a good set of position players. And so for that reason, I'm a little skeptical that they would make this jump. We're talking about already a competition of Tyler O'Neill, I think Dylan Carlson for center field, Juan Yepes, Nolan Gorman for some infield time, and he would be pushing somebody out, but he is doing some pretty outrageous things and has a huge future. What do you sort of forecast happening in the situation with Jordan Walker?
I think Walker's going to go back to AAA, and I'm fine with that for a lot of reasons. You know, he got off to this huge start at the beginning of spring training and then hasn't been quite the same. He also hurt his shoulder just a little bit, missed a couple days since he came back from that. He also hasn't been as good, but also he's facing more as spring training progresses. You're facing fewer and fewer guys who aren't major league players too. So I don't know if this is his shoulder's bothering him or if this is regression to the mean, or if this is he's just facing a better caliber of pitching now, but they have other guys to sort through anyway. And I think that that would be the right thing for them long term, both for Walker to get him a little bit more experience, but more importantly to sort through some of these other position players, particularly corner outfield candidates, to figure out who, you know, essentially who's a keeper and who's not, right? That's, I'm a big Dylan Carlson fan. That's the one guy I would say they've got to hang with. And I even said he was a breakout candidate for me last year. It didn't happen. I still believe maybe this is his year. I've had plenty of those guys in the past where I called for a breakout. I was just off by a year. I'll take partial credit for those guys, I guess. But see what Lars Nootbaar can do. See if Tyler O'Neill, I'm not a huge O'Neill fan. I said last year I expected him to regress, and he did. They've got to sort through some of those guys first. And then, because once Walker comes up, I am a very strong believer. You bring a guy like that up, and this would be true for Volpe too. The idea is they come up to stay. They're coming up. We're handing you a regular job, and this is your job basically for the rest of the season. And so for the Cardinals, also a contender, now likely playoff team, you want to know what you're doing. before you make that move and know what you're doing with other personnel and understand, okay, this job is open and it is going, it's Walker's now from now through the end of the season.
I'll look forward to your next article, which is Keith Law's 2024 breakouts. Predicting them. It won't happen this year. Cool.
No, it's just all the guys who don't break out from my list this year, I just roll them over.
Same list.
I'm still calling for the Ricky Weeks breakout. That's, what is this, year 12 or something?
It's happening. Well, that'll do it for today. You can check out all of Keith's work at theathletic.com. Get a subscription to The Athletic at theathletic.com/baseballshow. You can get a subscription for $1 a month for the first year. You can find Keith on Twitter at Keith Law. You can find me at Stephen J. Nesbitt. The Athletic Baseball Show is back next week. DVR is back next week. Have a great weekend.